Welcome to Movie Crush, a production of iHeartRadio.
W. Chuck Bryant here in the basement for the first of what will be a three-part series with the guys from the Flophouse, the Great Great Bad Movie podcast from the Max Fun Network, and my buddy Jesse Thorne. And I don't know why I haven't done this yet, because I know the guys, and the Flophouse is one of my favorite shows, and I'm glad it worked out that I could get all these three in a row. So up first, we have Dan McCoy. Dan is a great dude. He works as a writer for The Daily Show, one of my all-time favorite shows on television and favorite comedy shows, especially on television. And Dan is a good dude. We met at Max FunCon 4 or 5 years ago and hung out there all weekend with Stuart as well. Elliot wasn't at that one, so I had not met him at that point. But Dan is a very nice guy, very funny, a big-time film fan. And cinephile, like his knowledge is dare I say Casey-esque, as far as the movies he's seen and the movies he knows. He's extremely well read, a very smart guy, and just always a good conversationalist. And I was glad to get him in here to talk about his pick, Aliens, the 1986 classic from director and writer James Cameron. So strap in, everybody. Here we are with Dan McCoy on Aliens.
Is your hair a lot shorter than it used to be?
No, unless I saw you in one of my weird grow out my hair a little bit periods that you were clearly in right now. My beard's a lot shorter.
That's it. It's quarantine hair. There's not a lot I can do about it. I've asked Audrey whether she would cut it, and she seems very dubious about that idea.
So. Oh, man, that's funny. Usually, A significant other who cannot cut hair leaps at the chance to cut hair, you know?
I think she knows how difficult I am and is worried that she'll disappoint me in some way, but I do not care right now. I just want it gone.
Yeah, I think there's two versions of quarantine hair. There's that or the shaved head, which is what I had, 5 weeks ago. So this is 5 weeks in.
Well, I both have a large lump on my head and hair that does not take well to being that short. So
you got a lump?
I got to go with this. Yeah, it's like a mole.
Yeah.
But it is one of those that like grows year by year, and I'm thankful that it's hidden by hair.
Yeah, my friend had one of those. He just had it removed. You can do that, you know.
Yeah, I've thought about it.
What are you drinking, Dan?
I made myself a hurricane. That was why I was a little late. I'm sorry. I lost track of time, and then I was like, oh, I was going to get us cocktails. And
so what's in a hurricane?
It's dark rum, light rum, orange juice, passion fruit, grenadine, some lime, and a little simple syrup. Although I was so pressed for time, I just sort of toss a little sugar in there.
I'm drinking a giant gin and tonic because it's gin and tonic season for me. I've just left martini season, and red wine season sort of straddles that. I kind of always drink red wine, but it's also not the best summertime thing.
Yeah, I mean, there was a time where like I liked whiskey so much I would just drink it year round on ice, so it didn't kind of matter, but I find myself these days being drawn to something that feels a little lighter in the summer, although this has a bunch of fruit in it, so who knows how light it is really.
So Dan, we've hung out before on a few occasions at Max FunCon, which is like three nights of a great time in the John Hodgman cabin.
Yes.
It's you know, I've had many hangs there over many years, and the year that Flophouse was there was one of the best as far as that hang goes.
That was super fun, and I it was like my first peek inside. Like, there's such a small level of fame and celebrity that comes with podcasting, but it was my first like peek inside, like the idea that I was hanging out with the cool kids to some degree. And again, it's podcasting, so cool is graded on a really big curve. But you know, I was there, and I think it was I don't know whether it was Travis who was there or Jordan, or like it was one of them who was like, hey, come on, we're gonna go to Hodgman's cabin. And I mean, I don't know if I've said this out loud on my podcast, but I've desperately craved Hodgman's approval for years because because, you know, I mean, he worked at the Daily Show when I was there with John. I mean, I'm still there, but like when John hosted, Hodgman was one of the correspondents occasionally. And before that, I had known of him through This American Life, and known that he was Bruce Campbell's literary agent, among other people he was a literary agent for. Like, he'd done all these things and then somehow parlayed it into being, in addition to an author, like an actor and a sort of a comic performer. And I don't know, I just, he seemed so interesting and I admired him. And I think Hodgman also encourages the desire to please him by withholding it so much, his approval. And so I was very excited to go and hang out and then meet you through that as well.
Yeah, that's interesting. Old Haji. And then you were kind enough to come to one of the Stuff You Should Know shows at the Bell House last year, which was very cool of you to do. I know you guys perform at the Bell House a lot, one of your home venues, kind of like us.
Yeah. I mean, certainly when Elliot still lived in New York, less so now, but we try and work it in. They're so nice there.
Yeah, they're the best. How has that been with Elliot gone? I mean, I haven't really noticed because, you know, I've told you via text and you've kind of reciprocated that we both go to each other's podcast as a bit of comfort food. And, you know, I took a break and now have this backlog of flop houses that I've been kind of barreling through the last few weeks to ease my anxieties. But how's it been? I haven't noticed any difference with you guys kind of separated now.
Well, that's good. I do think that the first month or two was kind of rough, and I'm not really sure. I think one of the things that helped us is like a boring equipment thing where we both started recording into the same kind of digital recorder rather than the computer. And that helped a lot somehow, but also at the same time we got an editor. Like, I am not you know, I started the podcast, but that doesn't mean I know anything about podcasting, and I only ever learned enough to kind of do the job that I needed to do.
Yeah,
whereas now Jordan Cowling, who actually does was the producer for iPodius that Elliot and Hodgman did together, is our editor and our sound person, you know, really a second producer on the show. And
when did that start?
Like shortly before the new year, maybe like November or December last year. It's hard to I just think of it as starting at the time that I was burned out of being our own producer
after 13 years or whatever, 12 years.
Yeah. It really gave me a new lease on life when it came to podcasting.
Man. Yeah, I bet it was nice to hand those reins over. What Stuart and I talked a little bit about this, but I didn't want to, you know, I promise you that you would be the teller of the flop story. And I'd love to know how it all came about. I had no idea that you guys had been around that long.
Yeah. Well, I think that one of the reasons we're successful is we got in when there was very little competition.
And don't I know it, brother?
Yeah. We could build an audience because, like, people ask me now about being successful in podcasting. I'm like, time machine? Like, yeah.
That's what I say.
It's too big now, you know? They've got real money behind it unless you're... But back in the day, it was because I was struggling to do comedy. I didn't have a TV writing job at the time. I was just doing whatever comedy I could on the side, and also I was hanging out with Stuart, who went to my same college, he and I didn't really hang out at college. We had some very close mutual friends. But then when I came to New York, he was already here. And so I was like, okay, well, this is an instant friend, especially because he liked watching dumb movies. And right. So we would watch dumb movies together, and I thought he was very funny. And I'm like, okay, well, here's a couple different things that are going on at the same time. I want to get into comedy. He's very funny. We both like watching dumb movies. I've started to listen to podcasts. Jordan Jesse Go was like one of the very first I listened to.
Oh, cool.
So it's interesting that now we're on the Maximum Fun Network under Jesse's leadership.
Yeah.
But yeah, I was like, okay, well, this is a new thing that's starting out, and I think it is an easy way to get an audience. Whether or not people are going to listen, it's a way to get access to people that I might not have otherwise. And I thought, this is one of the first times in my life I was prescient about anything, or only times when I was like, oh, okay, like this could be a thing.
Right.
And I should get in now while it's early. And I got Stuart and another guy who was Stuart's friend, Simon, who then had to go back to Indiana about seven episodes in. He moved away.
Oh, wow.
Which you know, like... God bless him. He's a very nice man, but it was very good that Elliot came in shortly thereafter, because I don't know, like by happenstance, I feel like we fell into classic comedy roles where
yeah.
Stuart's like the laid back one and Elliot is like the motor mouth jokester and I'm the exasperated guy. You know?
Totally, dude.
So
it's such a fun dynamic though. I mean, that's what I love about the show. I mean, I rarely see the movies that you guys talk about, and it doesn't matter because the dynamic that the three of you have together, you know, like at least one or two times during every episode I go, oh, poor Dan. Because, you know, it's tough. Elliot's a force of nature. And you can tell, though, and I was talking to Stuart about this, like, you finally lost it a few weeks ago. I'm sure you've done that more than once. But when you finally just yelled to shut the fuck up, can I say one thing? And the two of them, like, it would not be a good show if that made it weird or if they got their feelings hurt. But they were totally just like, yeah, whatever, man, and just kind of kept going. And that's what makes the show special, I think.
No, and we are close enough that I can lose that patience. I mean, it helps that they've known me long enough to know that I get mad, but for very short periods of time.
You don't hold grudges.
Hold anything. Yeah. I mean, it is a little you ask about Elliot being gone. I guess the one thing that is kind of bad, and it's been amplified by the quarantine, is we are very close friends at this point. Like, it's weird for adults to say best friends, but they're probably my two best friends.
Yeah.
But nowadays we mostly talk business. Like we only like get together when we're doing the podcast. It's very easy to fall off without that. Like, whereas if Elliot was in town, maybe we would hang out together as friends. And so it is, I think, a little easier for us to get annoyed at each other.
Yeah.
Because we're business partners, but mostly not.
Totally. What was your childhood like? Where did you grow up? Did you say Illinois or Indiana?
Yeah, Illinois. I went to school in Indiana for college, but I grew up in a small town called Eureka, Illinois, which it's got like 5,000 some people who live there now, but it was even smaller when I grew up. Like, I think the population was closer to 3,500.
Wow. That is small town.
Yeah. And I always felt, I don't know, kind of like an odd person out. Not that, I mean, they're very nice people that I grew up with in that way that, you know, I make fun of small town living a little bit as I now live in New York City. But I do it from a place of being like, those are my people and I can do that. Like, there is a kindness sometimes associated with that and a closeness. Yeah. But at the same time, I also was, you know, like the son of a college professor and a librarian. living in an area that was not like heavily academic. It was not based on that. And we were a very liberal family in the middle of a very conservative area. So I did feel kind of weird growing up because of all that.
Now, were movies, you're such a film fan and like a true cinephile. That's one of the reasons I was excited about having you on, because and you can tell just from listening to the Flophouse at the end when you guys do your recommendations, you know, you go deep, you've seen a lot, you're a big fan of older movies, and you have just a lot of, I think, deep knowledge about film. Was that something that started when you were younger?
Yeah, I bought a, like I said, my mom was a librarian. She started out at the public library, and then later on she was the director of the library at the college in town, but I would go to book sales a lot, and for a quarter, I remember I bought one of those Roger Ebert movie yearbooks.
Oh yeah.
And I think as I've grown up, I've been impressed by how many people have had this kind of same experience with Roger Ebert, where I would just read through those reviews like it was a normal book.
Yeah.
You know, just because he was such a fan, and he was a good writer about film, and blessedly, I think he's a critic, but not particularly hard on movies. So like, he wants to like a movie, which led me to kind of be willing to check out whatever. And I would, you know, like on his recommendation, I would watch movies that he liked, and maybe I would also, maybe I wouldn't. Like, he was famously wrong about, like, I don't know. He like gave like Raising Arizona a 1.5-star review, which is nutty, But I mean, I think that started it. And then I would just read a bunch of books about movies, in addition to it being like, I was the youngest kid, so I think I was left to do whatever I wanted to in certain ways. And I would just sit in front of the TV watching movies. And also, I don't know, like, I remember stuff like that. Like, it shows where my head is at, that like, Audrey, my girlfriend, is sort of annoyed at me, I think, sometimes, that I can't recall people that I've met several times.
Uh-huh.
But at the same time, but like, I know that the dog in Pumpkinhead is the same as the dog in Gremlins, you know, like, it's the same dog actor named Mushroom. And like,
oh, wow. That's great.
That's in my head.
No, you know, man, we're kind of similar in that way. Emily, my wife, is always just laughing at that. A lot of it's a movie, but for me too, it's a lot of music factoids. Like, she'll make fun of me in the same way. Like, you can name the bassist for Poison, but you know, you can't remember the conversation that we had yesterday. It was pretty important. But those things get locked in, you know.
It wasn't like an argument per se, but we just had like a discussion about who was supposed to text whom back.
Uh-huh.
And like, apparently she had talked to me about that, and she says that that had happened, and I believe her. I think I just have forgotten it. Like, there are things that just slide out of my head.
Now, were you doing stand-up? Was that kind of your first foray into comedy?
I've done a little stand-up, never enough to call myself a stand-up, I think, because those people, like, they go out and do it every night, multiple times a night, if they want to be big. I was kind of a dabbler. Like, the best I ever did was some guy who used to be the warm-up comic at The Daily Show, like, once, like, wanted to throw together a show that said that, like, people were from The Daily Show just so he could get stage time, I'm sure, and asked me, like, hey, you want to come do this? And I was like, sure. Like, that was, like, the closest to a real club I ever played, because it was people in from out of town rather than like a bunch of comedy nerds. And I did, right. I did okay, but like, mostly I did like improv and sketch. And there was a short-lived humor magazine called Jest that another guy from my college, Rich Duncan, put out for a while that I wrote for. And through that I met a guy, Frank Lesser, who wrote for Colbert, and I came very close to getting hired on Colbert once, but I did not make it. Although, like, it's interesting. I went in and they had timed everything so that the people were like, you were sitting with your other candidates.
Oh, wow.
Like, they did not have it staggered out at all. And so I walked in and I, like, saw my friend Jack. And then I also saw this woman, Megan Gans, who, like, I'd seen before at, like, friends things. And we, like, chatted. I don't think that she would remember me, but I followed her career ever since then because she's, like, went on to write for Community and It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. And she's one of the people behind this Mythic Quest show on Apple TV. And I've been, like, weirdly proud that I that we both lost out on the same job because I think she's great. But it was a lot of kicking around trying whatever I could.
Now, how did The Daily Show happen?
The Daily Show happened because I had taken a lot of classes at the Upright Citizens Brigade Theater, as basically everyone in comedy did at that time. And I eventually just got kind of fed up with it because I think it's a good place for people to go, or it was, if they've closed down, but to, like, get plugged into the world.
Yeah.
But then you have to sort of keep paying to take classes and being around all the time to try and, like, snag on to whatever stage time you can. And that's the same, you know, a lot of places. But I wanted to go someplace else where I could just do stuff. And so my friend Eric had this small theater downtown called Juvie Hall that lasted for, like, I don't know, 4 years at most, because he was just renting it from a larger theater upstairs, and it never made that much money. But I met Elliot there doing shows. I did a show with him. I did a show with Sarah Schaefer, who had a show on MTV for a while. Uh-huh. Yeah. And like, the people who came out of that small theater have mostly gone on to do good stuff, which just goes to show, I think, that it doesn't necessarily matter where you're performing. It's just like a commitment and trying to stick with it. But I met Elliot there, and I immediately wanted to be friends with him. Partly, I admit that I was starstruck that he was a producer at that time at The Daily Show, but also he wrote a blog called The Oscars Are Always Wrong at the time. And it's since been lost because, like, whatever was hosting it has, like, went under or whatever. Uh-huh. But he was going, like, year by year saying, okay, well, this one this year in this category. Like, he went through, like, most of the categories and be like, this was a better movie. This, like, he knows all these classic movies. You're starting from the top. And I'm like, okay, well, I want to be friends with him. And I kind of made it my mission to become friends with him. And so we did the podcast together for a while, and when there was an opportunity at the show, he recommended me. And I actually, again, didn't get it, but they kept my name on file because I was very close to getting it.
Uh-huh.
And then, like, a month later, someone else left, and they brought me in. And so it was me and my friend Jubin Pereng coming in at the same time. He was the guy that they hired before me, and he's now, like, one of the top people at the show. So clearly they should have hired him before me, but but we both got jobs.
Now, what was the transition like between John and Trevor? Was that, I don't know how much you can talk about it, but how seamless or bumpy was that?
I mean, you know, it was a mix. I mean, like, Trevor is extremely nice, and he kept on, like, almost everyone who worked there, because, like, probably because he didn't, you know, he was coming from South Africa. He didn't necessarily have his own, like, quote, guys in the U.S. He brought a couple of people that were close to him along with him. But I think it was important to him to come in and be like, you all know how to make this show. And my version of the show is not going to be the same show, but, like, most of the skills, if you're nimble, are going to transfer, and you're all good at this. So, it's always just a question, I think, of voice. You have to unlearn how to write like John,
right,
and learn how to write like Trevor. And I think I was, for as much as Trevor was very positive about my writing from the start, I think I was a little rocky with that because I kind of have a hard time with change. So in my mind, I'm like, well, if it's funny, it's funny. But, like, I had forgotten the lesson that I knew when I first started the job, which is you know, so much of it is just writing to the person you're writing for.
Yeah. I mean, as a viewer, it was, it felt very smooth. I mean, it was the same show, but different. If that makes sense. Yeah. And which is, I think, the only way it could have gone and still maintained its success was not to completely revamp the show. It's still the Daily Show. And I think Trevor's great. I mean, I love John, but there was never any question like, you know, am I going to give this a try or anything like that?
Yeah, Trevor was in an impossible position, which is, I think, is why, like... Like, I don't think he'd be offended by me saying that, like, there were certainly big names that didn't want the job just because they thought, like, that's an impossible thing to follow this.
Yeah, it's a ballsy move.
Show. But he had the self-possession to think, like, okay, I can do it. I can do it in a different way.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, I think we suffered a little bit because people expected it to be exactly the same, or they expected like a total reinvention. I think you're right. Like neither one really would have worked, but people liked Rush to Judgment. But now I think that like people have had the time to adjust. They can see, you know, that it's good and it's different, but like, you know, I don't know. The show got nominated for Emmys a couple times. It's still a show that people enjoy. And honestly, like at the end, John was pulling in an older audience than would have stuck with the show.
Yeah.
Like Trevor has definitely brought the age down of the people who view it, which I'm sure everyone who is in charge of like the money is very happy with.
Yeah, absolutely. How many do you have Emmys in your apartment? Do you own Emmys?
Yeah, I guess I own them. That's such a funny.
Do you possess Emmys?
That is accurate, but I don't think anyone ever says that. It's funny. No, I have two. I got one. There's a period. I don't know if it's still true because it's been a while. But there's a period where the Emmy producers wanted to like, they're like, ugh, writers, who cares about writers? And they wanted to shove us off to the creative arts non-televised part of the Emmy show.
Yeah.
And the guild didn't like that. And I think there was like back and forth and it was like this 1 year on, 1 year off thing. So the first time I got one was actually
off.
On one of the off years.
Oh, man.
And I had convinced, because I was excited about it being in my first time, I had convinced like a couple other people to go. Like, this was actually right after one of the guys on the show, Rich Blomquist, got married to Kristen Schaal.
Oh, yeah,
and
sure.
We were all at the wedding, all the writers, and then like the Creative Arts Emmys was the same weekend. And I think that I sort of started a landslide of a few other people coming after this wedding that was crazy and had alpacas in it and parrots. and we went, and thank God that there were like four of us there because we won that year. And then the second time the writers won, it was actually a sweep for the show because it was John's last year.
Yeah, that's great.
And the funny thing is both times LL Cool J was our presenter. Both times I won an Emmy.
Oh, wow.
LL Cool J was the guy.
Man, that moment, the last one was just so great when he brought everybody out there. That was one of the cool moments because I've always been a fan of The Daily Show. I even watched back in, you know, the Kilburn days. And I've known... I think more so than any like other piece of entertainment, I've known more people. Like I know you, I know Chad Carter is an old buddy, mm-hmm. and I used to know Hallie Haglin a little bit and Jimmy Don a little bit and Wyatt. And
oh, wow.
If I added up, you know, there's probably like seven or eight people, I guess Hodgman included, from the Daily Show staff that I've kind of been pals with over the years. And it's just a great show. I love how it's just continued to be awesome. And I think maybe Trevor coming over as more of an unknown was the best move. You know, it would have been tough to have
some just sort of well-known American face kind of step in there, I think.
Yeah, I think so too. Hallie is so great.
She's still there?
Just because you've invoked her, I must say she's one of my favorites.
No, is she still working there?
She left to be, I don't know her exact title, whether she was executive producer. She was basically show running Wyatt's show on HBO for those two seasons. And now she's out in LA, and I believe she got a job right before everything hit. So I don't know what's happening with, I think she's still working, but I don't.
Yeah. Ellie's the best.
I wish I knew more about her life. She's a wonderful person. She is definitely one of those people, though, if you're not seeing her every day, it's easy to like for us both to like flake on each other, except right. for then occasionally she'll decide that she's sending me 10 texts in a day.
Well, tell her I said hi. I don't know if she'll remember me, but she's done a couple of things with stuff you should know over the years, and just a very
nice,
kind, funny person. You want to talk aliens?
Sure.
All right, dude. Well, you sent a list of films. Mm-hmm. Most of them range from His Girl Friday to, was North by Northwest on there?
Yeah.
And maybe
it could have been any
ones.
Hitchcock movie, basically, almost, but North by Northwest was my first love.
Yeah. And then we settled on Aliens somehow, which I'm glad because the 1986 sci-fi action, I think even more horror than I remember now that I saw it again last night, from James Cameron. And here's my deal. I've seen Alien probably, I don't know, 15 times, and it's one of my favorite movies. And I saw Aliens and loved it back in the day, and I think I must have seen it a couple of times after, maybe like in college on, you know, on VHS, but really had not seen it in probably 20 years.
Wow. Yeah, it is one of the movies I watched the most when I was a teenager. It was that and Heathers and Army of Darkness. I had them on VHS tape.
Yeah.
No, I still love all of them, but I would watch them over and over. And so I hadn't seen it for a long time just because I knew it so well, other than the Brooklyn Academy of Music had like a series that was actually on puppeteering.
Oh, wow.
And they were like, it was taking like kind of a broad view of it. So they had aliens in there too, since so much of that is puppeteering. And, it worked great on a big screen with an audience. I mean, this time, like, I watched it and it's also familiar to me. I still enjoyed it. I was still like paying deep attention to it while Audrey sat next to me playing Animal Crossing. She liked it fine, but you know, I think that she's not like greatly younger than me or anything, but she is 32 to my 41, and I think that sometimes with movies like that,
yeah,
they become so influential that they seem old when you see them for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
If you didn't see them at the time,
yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
She still thought it looked great and was engaging, but I think that like there have been too many movies that stole from it at this point. But
now I watched the extended version, which is streaming on Hulu. I'd never seen that one before. I assume you've seen that version.
That was what I watched last night. And I think it is the better cut with one big exception.
Which is what?
I think we don't need to see the terraformers on the colony before all hell breaks loose. Because, like, you know that as soon as you hear that they're colonists on LB 482 or whatever it is, or 486, I don't remember, you know that they're going to be eaten by aliens or, you know, bred by aliens, whatever you want to say the xenomorph does. I don't know. turned into little more xenomorphs. So you don't need that scene to, I don't know. I think it's less effective for when like Newt finally shows up to have seen her before. I don't know.
No, you know what? I think you're right. And that the actor is not especially good. who plays Papa Terraformer. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think you're right. It didn't offend me or anything, but now that you mention it, it's, you don't need to see it. I see why it was cut. The other parts, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but the Sigourney Weaver finding out about her daughter.
Yes.
That was great. And I'm surprised they cut that.
Yeah. That is the part I think that the movie, I mean, the movie, the theatrical version is amazing still, but I think that the movie hurts the most for that cut because the movie is so much about motherhood. Like it's,
oh, yeah.
It's like funny. Like it's like this action horror movie about motherhood, but, you know, like with, Newt being Sigourney Weaver's surrogate daughter, but also this queen alien.
Yeah, exactly.
Just like protecting her eggs.
Yeah.
It's just strange, I think, to have that gone. And the other big difference is the scene with the sentry guns, as all the rounds, you see them ticking down.
I thought that was pretty cool.
I mean, I think that's a great suspense scene. It's definitely something that you could cut, but I still love having it.
No, I thought it was good. Yeah. And I had, you know, I hadn't seen it in so long. I wasn't exactly sure what was new and what wasn't. And I, you know, went and did the research and found those three scenes, and it sort of jogged my memory that they weren't as familiar, but I thought the sentry gun scenes were pretty awesome.
Yeah. Well, when I saw it as a kid, like that was one of the scenes that really terrified me the most. And I want to speak to what you said before about horror movie. Like, I think that the accepted line, like internet crowd think, has proclaimed that Alien is a horror movie and Aliens is an action movie. And I don't necessarily buy it. I mean, I see what they're saying. It's a more action oriented movie, but I think that, like, as you said, it's action, science fiction, horror altogether. The typical thing people say about Alien is, oh, it's a haunted house movie in space. And that's true in so much as it's about this like closed unit of space that people are stuck in with something bedeviling them. But it also, I think it plays a lot more like a slasher because it's these characters getting split up and taken out one by one.
Totally.
And Aliens, I think, is more like kind of a horror movie in the zombie movie category. Like those are usually more action oriented. You're being besieged by a lot of monsters.
Yeah, and it's if you listen to Friendly Fire, they covered that on their war movie podcast and make the argument that it's also a war movie, which, you know, you've got this battalion of Marines and it has a lot of the familiar war movie tropes for sure. This sort of ragtag, dirty dozen like group of, you know, foul mouthed soldiers. So it's interesting. It pulls in all these different elements. But last night it just kept hitting me more and more, all the different horror elements that I kind of didn't remember as much being there as in Alien. And I think there's just as many in Aliens as Alien.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right. It's definitely also a war movie in that you could easily kind of read it, I guess, as this Vietnam metaphor where this cocky group of soldiers comes in and then is completely overwhelmed by this force that is like, you know, seems to come out of nowhere. And
And it's not, you know, they have this technologically superior firepower that they just take for granted will overwhelm anything and, you know, quickly find out that they're wrong.
Yeah. And it's interesting. Audrey is pointing out that, like, this is one of the few movies that always wants you to side on the end kind of running away, almost. Like,
yeah.
like there's no point during this movie where you think that the movie wants you to think that going back and dealing with some aliens is a good idea.
Yeah.
Like from the start, Sigourney Weaver doesn't want to do it, but she kind of does it because she thinks she needs to face her fear. She's so terrified. She wants to, like, if it's out there, she has to know it's been dealt with. She, like, it's almost a compulsion with her, but she knows it's not a good idea. She tells them it's not a good idea.
Yeah.
Like, as soon as it's bad, she's like, we got to get out of here and nuke it from space.
Yeah.
And there's not the usual, like, stuff that a movie tries to pull where it's like, no, we can still save these people. It's like, no, those people are gone.
Yeah.
We got to get out of here.
Yeah. And, you know, Bill Paxton also clearly is very famous in this movie for just being sort of a whiny, let's get out of here, man. I mean, I love Bill Paxton. It's so funny. This is one of the most obnoxious characters in the history of movies. And Bill Paxton as a real human was just such a sweet guy. And I remember listening to the Marc Maron interview with him and just being like, did you hear that? Do you listen to the Maron shows ever?
I have. I don't think I've heard the Paxton one.
Man, you should check it out because you can't listen to it and not be like, boy, I really want to be Bill Paxton's next door neighbor and like go over and barbecue at his house. He just seemed like such a decent, great guy.
Yeah. Well, I think that it is that sweetness that's you can sense in him that lets you not be totally annoyed by that character. That and the fact that he's right in being as scared as he is.
Yeah, he's right every time.
But it's interesting.
Now, what are your thoughts on James Cameron? Let's talk about him for a minute. Where do you stand with him?
I think he's largely great. I mean, for the most part, I love his stuff. I mean, so he did this right after The Terminator, which is crazy. Like, he went like from modestly budgeted like huge success to like this, you know, giant sequel, but I mean, The Terminator is another thing that gets classified as an action movie that I think is as much horror as it is action.
Yeah.
And I think it's terrific. And then this is amazing. Terminator 2, I think, actually is the thing. Like, unlike, I don't feel the same big change from Ridley Scott's Alien to Aliens in terms of not being horror as I do actually. Like, Terminator 2, I think, becomes much more of a straight action film.
Yeah, for sure.
But it's an amazing one. I love the first two acts of The Abyss.
I love The Abyss.
I think probably my least favorite movie of his is actually True Lies, because I feel like, weirdly, for such like a macho filmmaker, women come off very well in his movies and are given like they are always as capable, if not often much more capable than the men, other than I think True Lies is kind of abominable in the way it treats Jamie Lee Curtis's character. But
that's my least favorite too.
People make fun of Avatar. Avatar was fine. Like, it's fun. Like, I don't have a need to revisit it not in 3D, but in 3D it was amazing. And Titanic is, you know, has become, I think, a bit of a joke just because people are all ashamed that they got suckered in by such a melodramatic movie and they all cried and they're like, no, I wasn't crying, but
I totally cried. I loved it first time I saw it. In fact, I've seen Titanic a bunch of times. I think it works.
I think
it works pretty well as a movie still.
Yeah. I think the biggest rap against James Cameron is like, so with Aliens, right? There's not a lot of memorable lines because the lines are memorable. Like, usually the lines are memorable because the actors are so good saying them.
Yeah.
And like they put an interesting spin on them. And I think the rap against him is usually like, oh, he can't, his dialogue is usually just serviceable.
Yeah. That's where I stand.
I see that, but I also think like he is a genius at constructing a story that is thrilling. And his dialogue may not be amazing, but he can present a character to you very quickly, and you know exactly who that character is, and exactly like whether you like them or not, or he paints very quickly, but very indelibly, and in a way that connects right away. And so, I'm willing to forgive the shortcomings, I guess.
Yeah, man, you said it best. I'm sort of right. Parking my car in your garage there. I've always knocked him as a writer, but as you know, and listeners, it's a good lesson to learn. There's more to writing than just the words that people say. He's very kind of on the nose and tropey, and some of the lines of dialogue he writes, I'm just still angry about. notably in Titanic when Billy Zane says something about the Picasso or whatever, and nothing will ever become of him. And
I knew exactly which line you were going to say.
I hate that stuff so much because I can just picture James Cameron patting himself on the back at how clever that is, and it's not. But there is so much more to writing and to writing a movie than the words that people say. And
yeah,
you're right. The way he establishes character so quickly, he writes a hell of an action movie and action sequences, because, you know, someone has to write that stuff. It's not, he's also the director, but you got to put that down on paper, on the page. And it's hard for me to admit that he is a successful writer for what kinds of movies he's making, but he is.
Yeah. I mean, like, and you see this on all levels, right? Because, like, I'm not going to give something like 50 Shades of Grey, let's say, credit for being well-written at all. But clearly the person who wrote it, whether or not it's for me, has a talent at connecting with people,
like, yeah,
of making them want to read the thing. And that is a thing that I think critics don't tend to value, but is maybe the most valuable part in terms of, like, if you want an audience to be interested in what you're doing. Well, again, not my thing, but
right,
you have to, like, I don't know. Like, the older I get, the less snobby I feel like I get about a lot of things. I'm like,
I
oh,
do too.
You know what?
Yeah.
you did a good thing here.
Yeah, that's kind of great. It's kind of one of the great things about getting older is you don't care about being cool anymore or liking the coolest things, and you get way less snobby about stuff and more brave about just saying, like, yeah, I like that. Fuck you.
Yeah. Yeah.
This movie has a lot of the DNA of Terminator, and I'm sure you know this, but for the listener, this movie was made, he kind of got the green light to make this movie. It had been in the hands of lawyers and there were lawsuits, and that's why it took so long to get a sequel made. And when it finally came together, they hired Cameron on the strength of the Terminator doing well, but he had already written the treatment and then got a chance to write even a sort of a short version of the script before Terminator came out. And the studio was like, this guy's okay. But then Terminator was a big hit and they were like, all right, he's the dude. But you can see a lot of the same DNA in the way it looks. Both have these great, strong female protagonists that are being gaslighted at the beginning of the movie. I guess that more or less happens a little bit more in Terminator 2. But she's, you know, Sarah Connor, I feel like, is always being gaslighted in that series.
Yeah, Audrey was asking me, and apologies if I'm stepping on a question you were going to ask, like, why I like this, why I chose this, say, rather than Alien. I mean, I'm sure you've done Alien, but, like,
have not yet.
Okay. Well, I was like, well, I mean, among other things, like, I think Alien is probably the more, quote, like, perfect movie. It's the more unified movie. It's the more unique movie. It
more artistic, maybe.
Us. Yeah. But in terms of, like, the fun I have watching it.
Yeah.
I have more fun watching Aliens, and also, like, I appreciate intellectually the fact that in Alien, you don't necessarily know who the, quote, hero is at the beginning.
Like, yeah.
Ripley sort of emerges from the crowd as she sort of proves herself, like, how competent she is, and, like, that combined with just the luck of surviving. And that's interesting to me as a way of writing a movie, but Weaver is so good in this movie, and to have her be, like, front and center and, like, so emotionally, like, you empathize with her right away. She's so capable. Like, she grows through the movie. Like, she turns into this warrior like, to some degree, but at the same time, you can see that she has it in her from the start. And one of the great things about it, we were talking about how, in general, again, other than Jamie Lee Curtis, I think Cameron does pretty well by female characters. Like, one of the things I like best about this movie is the way that Hicks reacts to Ripley.
Yeah.
Like, you don't know who he is at the beginning of the movie. He's this like grunt who kind of seems a little sardonic and like he's a loner. He doesn't, you know, maybe buy into all this shit, but he's also good at it. And as Ripley like sort of emerges as the one making the most sense, like the smartest one in the room, you know, he willingly like immediately supports her.
Oh yeah.
Without like trying to take over. Like he's happy to like take a back seat to the person that he thinks is best equipped to like to handle this. And there's like a, you know, there's a hint of attraction between them, but there's the movie also doesn't shoehorn romance in. There's no time for
totally.
That. There's aliens, you know?
Yeah. So and I think that's cool. He could have done that too. He could have shoehorned more of that. There's that one sort of interaction and the one line that they have together. What does he say? Something like we don't have to get engaged or something like that.
Yeah, he gives her like the tracking bracelet. And it doesn't mean we're married or anything, or something like that. Like,
yeah, and that was just enough, man. Just a little, especially for Cameron, who tends to kind of hit the viewer over the head with whatever he's trying to get across. I thought that he showed some restraint there. But that's one of my favorite parts of the movie when he backs her, and like she's sort of in charge at that point, basically.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, Gorman's out of the picture, and so she correctly judges that like Hicks is smart and will back her, and like points out that he's in charge, and they sort of form an alliance. And yeah, it's it's nice. I mean, like I said, everything is drawn very quickly and in a way that you understand and makes sense like character wise in the middle of all this action.
Yeah, Ripley's just, I mean, top five movie characters, movie heroes for me. She's just such a badass, and you know, the hero's journey for her is just so rich, and her character arc is so rich, and Sigourney Weaver just acts the hell out of it. Never over the top. She's always, she just always hits all the right notes, I feel like.
Yeah. Yeah. And she's such a great actress, and she was a big star, but I think that also one of those stars that almost in spite of being big, like people didn't totally know what to do with because she's so strong and she's like, she is beautiful, but like in a different way, and she can do drama. And she's like super funny in something like Ghostbusters.
Yeah.
And it's almost like, I think she's almost like such an imposing presence that people must have been scared of her almost. Again, huge star, but she must have been kind of a hard one for Hollywood to figure out because she doesn't fit into boxes, I don't think.
No, I'm totally with you. I don't know if you're a big fan of the movie The Ice Storm. We covered that on the show, and it's one of my favorite movies. And just seeing her in that, too, like, she's got such range.
Yeah.
She's just awesome. I wish I saw more of her these days.
Yeah. No, and I love that she'll show up and do, like, a random voice on something. Like,
oh, does she?
Yeah, I mean, I mean, this is old at this point. Like, I know Futurama, like, she did something for them. But like I do think that she kind of enjoys dipping in and doing like a silly comedy thing.
Yeah.
Or a cameo with a lot of impact, you know.
That's cool. I do like it at the beginning too, that little bit where you see the you know, there are a couple of nods to Alien, and one of them is at the beginning when it just has on the video screen behind her, you see Yaphet Kotto and then Harry Dean Stanton. And that's just, you know, I think Cameron did the right thing and basically saying, I mean, such a great setup for a sequel. It's like, well, you liked it, the Alien, like, and even called it Aliens. Like, how about one where there's a bunch of them?
Yes.
And it just ramps up the action. And it was just such a smart plan to sequelize this film.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, nowadays, I feel like that is, you know, the obvious playbook,
right?
To be like, okay, well, it's bigger this time. Like, that is what, like, but I don't think so much at the time it was like a cliche, and it is such a clever thing. Like, okay, Ripley's now isolated from her past experience. It's much later, and now she's going to go back. And the thing that horrified her, there's a bunch more of them. I mean, the one place where it kind of gets a loses a little is that these new aliens are a lot easier to kill than that one that she encountered before. And, you know, you can sort of write that off to the fact that these are Marines and they have actual guns now. But
yeah, true.
But that's the only thing you kind of lose in that scenario. But it is, but then again, it is like super smart. It was, and I didn't even think about it really that much until this viewing Cameron's like, okay, well, if she's fighting a bunch of aliens throughout the movie,
yeah,
there has to be a climactic thing. Like, what is a climactic thing?
Right.
And so he introduces the idea, and he does it. He sets it up well throughout the movie that, like, oh, in this alien society, there's probably a queen.
Yeah.
And then she meets the queen. And so it gives her at the last moment, very late in the movie, a big thing to fight. But that doesn't keep the queen alien from being any less iconic, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it's sort of like the video game, you know, it's like fighting the boss at the end.
Exactly.
They're fighting all these aliens who, in the first movie, like you said, there's just one of them, and it's still so goddamn scary. And this one, I think he knew, like, you can't just add more aliens.
Yeah.
We're going to do that, but it can't just be that. You still had to have a great story, and that, like you said, that climax with the queen at the end, it's just, you know, that's the only way this could finish.
And I also think that Cameron pioneered a notion that, like, I mean, at this point, it's gone too far, and I find it frustrating in action movies where they have ending after ending after ending.
Yeah, yeah.
Like they took the lesson to heart too much, but I think Cameron was one of the people who pioneered, like, okay, well, I'm not going to give you one climax. There's actually going to be a couple of climaxes. Like,
yeah,
the movie could easily end with them, like, flying away from the planet and blowing up, but then the queen has made it onto the ship, and you have the great loader fight.
Oh, man, I mean, that last 10 minutes is, like, some of the best part of the whole movie.
Yeah.
And then,
yeah,
you know, he plants the, in a very non-subtle Cameron way, he has the foreshadowing of the loader machine,
yes,
bot or whatever at the beginning, and the fact that she can drive it and she's super adept at it. And it's just, you know, it's like the gun in Act One. You're just waiting, yeah, for it to come back.
I mean, it, you're right. It isn't subtle, but I also think it is done in such a, if you're not going to be subtle, at least do it with some humor, because that scene is so much fun.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's her proving herself to these macho jerks and showing, like, she can do stuff. And I don't know the actor who plays the sergeant's name or whatever, but the guy who always has the cigar, like, his,
yeah,
delighted reaction, yeah, to her being able to pilot it is great.
Yeah, very tropey and kind of perfect. Yeah. And that's what I love about Cameron too. Like, he is tropey, but these, we talk a lot about tropes on the show. Tropes are tropes for a reason, because they generally work. It's not like people keep doing the same thing over and over because it doesn't work for movies. Like,
yeah,
he's a movie maker. He makes these big movies that feel and look like movies and smell like movies. And you go in the summertime and you sit down and you watch Aliens and you leave just with a big grin on your face. You know, there's something to be said for that.
Yeah. I mean, I don't, like, the thing is, there are people making this kind of incredibly skilled blockbuster today. You know, they're few and far between, but they've always been kind of few and far between the really good ones.
Yeah.
But I my reaction to them will be less often as intense just because I am older.
Like, right.
Aliens is such a huge crowd pleasing movie that's also thrilling and scary, and I saw it, you know, when I was like 12 or 13 or whatever, so
yeah, it's kind of perfect in that way.
Yeah.
The motion tracker device is so brilliant as a film filmmaking device, because it, you know, it adds a literal ticking sound. You know, the ticking clock is always great for suspense. And then just the brilliance of seeing it coming, them not seeing it, but they hear it coming. And you can just get so much out of the visual and that sound. It's all just so great. It's such a brilliant idea.
No, it's terrific. Although, like, I wonder how, like, some of the technology plays for new viewers, like, absolutely new viewers now, because, like, I think the movie still looks amazing.
Yeah, it holds up pretty well.
But, like, technology like the trackers or the, like, video camera or whatever, it is this, like, futuristic yet retro thing where it's like, okay, like, we can make these amazing special effects, but we're going to imagine that, like, everything looks like a VHS tape in the in the future, you know, or like the tracker is just going to be like a couple blips on a green grid or whatever it is.
Yeah, I think it holds up. The one part to me that suffered the most was that fucking car, the transport vehicle or whatever.
Yeah.
That one doesn't hold up super well. It doesn't, especially when you've seen things since then, like the Batman tumbler and like these vehicles look like they could totally really work on that terrain.
No, it looks like a first draft for the tumbler, and you don't believe that anything that bulky is going to be able to like handle to drive down these hallways to wherever they are. The funny thing about this movie is like I have no sense of a lot of the geography in the whole thing, and yet it still works. Like you within the scene, you know the geography of everything that's going on, but from scene to scene, I'm often not sure. I'm like, okay, where the base are they supposed to be right now?
I never really thought about that, but you're kind of right. It's it is sort of a big dark not a dark mess, but and you know, maybe that's part of it. Maybe that was purposeful to just sort of disorient and lose you as a viewer. I don't know.
Yeah.
Is that a reach?
No, I don't think it's a reach, but I do think it also is just like a side effect of they decided on kind of one look for the way space colonies and starships look in this universe. And then every place looks like that look. Like I was looking at Sigourney Weaver's, like Ripley's apartment, for instance, when she comes back, and I'm like, Jesus Christ. And the future, like, is there no color? Like, does no one like decorate their place? It's also grim.
Little white IKEA pod. And I think just like Alien 2, the other thing that stood out to me was how long he takes to get to the alien. Like there's a lot of restraint in this movie for that. You know, the lessons of Jaws and Alien. I think it's a full hour in when you finally get to see the Xenomorph for the first time.
No, I was reflecting on that too, rewatching it. None of it feels like, I mean, none of it's dull. I mean, I don't think that if you're a good filmmaker, any sort of like laying of groundwork is dull, but like it all moves, it all explains who the characters are, it puts the pieces in place while still like having a lot of suspense on its own before the monster shows up. But yeah, it is very good at withholding, and then all hell breaks loose.
Yeah, well, I think that's sort of the key, is they withhold, and then once that shit starts, it's really just a sort of a nonstop set piece after that, kind of one after the other. There are a couple of brief moments of kind of gathering yourself where you can take a breath, but just some great, great action. So much that a character like Newt doesn't even spoil it.
Oh, you don't like Newt?
Dude, I don't like Newt, and I have a 5-year-old daughter, so.
Well, for me with Newt, like, I do not like child characters in movies that are not about children.
Yeah.
Like, if it's a movie about children, then that's a different story, but oftentimes they are precocious actor types.
Yep.
Or they have been shoehorned into a story where they shouldn't be, because like somewhere along the line, someone thought, okay, we need someone cute in here, or they are written as if they're adults. Like, they speak as if they're adults, which is the thing that annoys me the most. Like, the precocious kid who, like, makes jokes that no kid would ever make.
It's the worst.
But I like Newt. Like, Newt is actually probably my favorite child character in a non-child movie because I think, you know, she's good at being shell-shocked. She doesn't actually talk that much. She's, like, been traumatized by this, but she's holding on. She makes sense in the context of the story. She makes sense in the themes of the story.
Yeah.
Like, she has this weird accent that I don't know what it is. I looked her up. She, like, was, like, weird. She's from Florida. It's not, like, but...
It's not a Florida accent.
Like, it gives, like, an off-kilter delivery to things that doesn't feel fake to me. So, I like her.
Up with Newt?
Yeah, up with Newt, as far as I'm concerned. I was very mad when Alien 3 killed off her and Hicks, and that is why, in my mind, those films are not canonical. Nothing is canonical after Aliens.
Yeah, I mean, Newt was okay. She bugged me a little bit. I totally get her function. And it did work, you know, as a function with the sort of motherhood through line that you were talking about. And I guess, you know, we needed more than Jonesy in this one. Although we do get Jonesy at the beginning, which is great.
Yeah, I love that.
And I wondered last night, I was like, man, I've had a bunch of fucking cats. Why have I never had a cat named Jonesy? What a dum-dum.
Yeah.
What's your cat's name?
Archie.
Archie, that's right.
Which is actually named after Cary Grant, Archibald Leach, real name.
Very nice.
Very snotty way of naming a cat.
Let's talk about Paul Reiser for a second.
Oh, yeah.
He's great in this movie.
Yeah, like, he is obviously, like, Weasley from the start, but in that, like, he's, like, treating Ripley with such condescension. He keeps, like, calling her kiddo and whatnot, but it's still Paul Reiser, still this, like, comedy guy, you know, and he's showing her enough empathy that the first time you see this movie, you're like, okay, well, he's, like, a company guy, but, like, maybe he's actually on her side. Maybe he's the one person on the company who's not, like, a sleaze, but
I bought it.
Yeah. But then he, like, he's revealed as such, I think, a blank-eyed monster. Like, even when he is confronted, he is still sort of insisting upon his, like, empathy and the smartness of his play, you know? Yeah. And it's one of these things that you always have to accept in these movies, that, like, these Weasley people are like, no, we can use it as a bioweapon. It's fine when, you know, obviously this thing cannot be controlled, but I've seen enough bad stuff happen in the world that I'm like, yeah, okay, there are people out there who are just that dumb, who are that devoted to wanting weapons. It's fine. I'll accept that.
Yeah, I kind of believed. I'm not sure how much I remembered about what happened to his character. So even last night, after 20 years, I found myself saying, like what you're saying, he's a company man, but, like, he does seem to like Ripley, and I think he may actually be an ally. I think he walks that line very well as an actor in this, and just goes so fully bad there at the end, like, literally leaves her to die by turning that monitor off. Such a fucking weasel.
Like, in terms of it being a horror movie, like, that impregnation scene where he leaves the two facehuggers in for Ripley and Newt, like, the attempted incubation thing is, I think, the scariest part of the movie, like, with those. I mean, it might be partly because I think spiders are very creepy. The unnaturalness of their construction freaks me out. And so these facehuggers skittering around trying to, like, put eggs inside these people is terrifying.
Yeah, it's the worst. That also reminds me of that great shot kind of early on after you see that facehugger of Sigourney Weaver's hand. That close up of her hand, and it totally, like, looks like a face hugger. She has, like, kind of long bony fingers. It's great.
This movie's good. It's a good movie. I'm going to go out on all them, say it's a good movie.
Lance Henriksen
We should talk about him for a sec. He takes over for, I guess, Ian Holmes' Android. And the whole Alien series has always done a really great job with the... are they called androids? What are they called in this?
I think he says that he prefers the term synthetic human.
Yeah, synthetic like humans. That. Exactly.
Watching it last night, I was struck by... Bishop makes such a huge impression in the movie, mm-hmm. but he is not in it all that much.
Yeah.
Like, he does the knife thing at the beginning, and then he's sort of like...
Great scene.
Around doing like medical stuff and being mistrusted by Ripley since she's had obviously a terrible experience with a synthetic person in the last one. And then he volunteers to be the one to go and get the ship. And so like he's taken out of the action for a huge portion and only comes in again at the end. And, you know, he helps Newt, but like he doesn't have a big part in the final battle or anything. But I think that Lance Henriksen is so... iconic. Like there's something about him.
Yeah.
He's such an interesting presence just as a human being.
Yeah.
But he's also like so good at seeming a little synthetic, but also I feel like, you know, I trusted him right away when I first saw Alien and knew that, like, you know, Ripley was wrong to mistrust him because he projects like this stalwart attitude in the movie too.
Yeah. I mean, I think I didn't trust him because of the first movie fully. Like I was just sort of where Ripley was. But he turns out to be kind of one of the heroes of the movie and a really pure stand up guy. And it really is sort of, there's some emotion to it when I was watching it last night when he, And it's also badass when he gets picked up and ripped apart so quickly, ripped into two pieces by the Queen Mother. But when he's laying there, you know, half laying there, and he saves Newt, like that packs an emotional punch that I don't remember feeling when I was, you know, 16, probably because I was 16.
Yeah. And as we know, everything after this movie didn't happen.
Right.
And so they took Bishop home and repaired him and he's fine.
That's right. I have a hard time remembering Alien 3 at all.
I mean, the thing is, it's not a bad movie. I mean, it's a David Fincher movie. It was famously like messed with a lot. They like did a bunch of stuff to it, and it was a chaotic production. I think things were being rewritten all the time while it was going. But, you know, it's hard for someone that talented to make something that's a piece of junk. There's a lot of, like... very striking imagery in it. It starts from that problem of killing off these characters that were very meaningful to people, and then it just gets bleaker from there. And, you know, if it was its own movie unconnected with Aliens, I would like it a lot more.
Yeah. I mean, that last sequence is so good. And like you said, the sort of false ending and the one more big, you know, it's all, and that's sort of a horror movie thing too. Like the killer's not dead. There's one more battle to fight, but he doesn't overdo it. It works really well here. I know that Gene Siskel famously had a problem with this movie and then the use of Newt as a, he thought it was sort of sadistic almost to use her as a prop at the end of this movie. And I didn't see that at all. I mean, to me, it worked in the action of the moment, which was that vacuum chamber was open to space and things were getting sucked out. Like it all made sense. It didn't feel gratuitous to me.
Yeah. I mean, I like Ebert a lot more than Siskel Ebert was like a movie aficionado. And I think Siskel was more of a guy who kind of like was a newspaper guy who got shunted into writing about movies and liked them well and was a smart guy. But
yeah.
But both of them, I think, at least earlier in their careers, kind of fell victim a little bit to kind of moral panic stuff at times, which is weird considering, for instance, that like Roger Ebert wrote Beyond the Valley of the Dolls and
sure.
and such. And like, and he, you know, it's he gave like Last House on the Left a 4-star review, and that is a brutally upsetting movie. Like, I don't know. I mean, I like Wes Craven's later stuff, but I don't know how much I actually like Last House on the Left. But so they were all over the place sometimes with that stuff.
Well, but Ebert also wasn't afraid to go back, like you said earlier, and say he got something wrong.
Yeah.
Which for a critic, that's sort of a bold move. You know, I think a lot of critics will die on that hill, even if they know they're wrong, just because they think that might, whatever, put a chink in their armor or something.
Yeah. Yeah.
Did you ever see that documentary about him, Life Itself?
Yes, I saw it. And I also have the book, both excellent. Yeah.
Yeah. Cause you're an avid reader. Another thing that, you can't listen to the Flophouse and not pick up on the fact that you and Elliot, and Stu, but you guys are all like film junkies and well-read and, you know, it's as silly as the show is. It's a smart show at the same time.
Well, I appreciate it. It's good that we somehow found some place to put all this stuff. Like for most people, spending so much time on entertainment would be a little bit of a waste, no matter how pleasurable it might be. But at least we've figured out a way to roll it into something productive.
Totally. Well, you got anything else on Aliens? I feel like we did a pretty good job.
I think we actually touched on all the sort of the thoughts I had while rewatching it.
All right. Well, we'll finish up with 5 questions then. I didn't tell you that we do this, but because I like to get your instinctual answers. But Dan McCoy of The Daily Show, what was the first movie you remember seeing in the theater?
I think the first movie I remember seeing is Never Cry Wolf.
Oh, I remember that.
Yeah. Well, you're one of the few. I mean, I think it was well received at the time, but it's not super well known. But yeah, I think it's about a guy who went up and lived with the wolves, a naturalist.
Totally remember that movie. Yeah. It was Disney, right?
I don't remember a lot of it because I was so young. I remember that Brian Dennehy was in it. I remember that they like deposit him in Alaska from an airplane. And I remember that he falls through the ice at one point. I think he eats a mouse at one point. That's about it.
That's kind of what I remember too. I remember the mouse thing for sure.
Yeah.
It's so funny. What was the first R-rated movie you saw?
Oh, geez.
Would that have been a big deal?
I mean, it might've been this. I don't know. I have this memory, like, this is not an R-rated movie. This is PG-13.
Aliens?
Think. No. The one I'm about to mention. Sorry, I have a bad habit sometimes of starting, like, reversing the order in a sentence of things. But, I remember my brothers, and they deny this happening, but I remember them, like, closing the curtains and making me watch movies like this and Poltergeist, which I think was PG-13, unless it was before that was a thing. It could have been in the PG days, but so they would force these things on me. Like, but this is probably not the right one, but it's the one I remember. Although, like, I don't know, my parents were very, for all that, like, my dad was a minister before I was born, and my mom was raised by a Methodist minister. They weren't really that concerned by the time I was around as the youngest.
Yeah, same
about,
here.
Like, what was on television. So, you know, I would walk in, and they'd be watching Stripes or whatever, you know?
And, right. Like,
it'd be fine, so.
No, that's cool. I was the youngest, too, so they still had they weren't super permissive growing up Baptist about what I could watch. But by the time I sort of cracked that window open with Escape from New York, after that, it was kind of all bets were off. They're like, yeah, whatever. You've seen one. Now you can just see whatever. I kind of had an issue with Stuart on this question too, since you guys do the Flophouse. But the question is this: do you walk out of a bad movie for someone who does a bad movie podcast?
You know, once I'm at the theater, I basically don't. The one time I can remember walking out of a movie, it was not because it was bad. It was just I was not in the mood. Like, I was going to the Korean horror movie The Eye because I had heard it had good reviews, and it was my birthday, and like honestly, I'm such a movie nerd that like that's all I want to do on my birthday to celebrate is go see a movie.
Yeah,
and I just was in it for half an hour. I'm like, you know what? This isn't what I want right now.
Right.
And nothing is forcing me to stay. So let's go. You know?
Right. So you left.
Yeah. And, you know, my apologies to The Eye. I'm sure you're a good movie, but not what I wanted right then.
I'm sure you're a good movie, Eye. Number four, I tailor to the guest. So as a comedy writer, I'm going to ask you, what movie, you know, let's say it's a world where a movie can be co-written or there's a writer's room for all these films. What movie do you wish you would have been a writer for or in that room coming up with the jokes? And I guess it doesn't have to be a comedy, but you'll probably say Hitchcock or something.
Well, no, I mean, I'm torn between two things, and that's either a Marx Brothers movie because I feel like that was the earliest, strongest influence on me in terms of just finding something hysterically funny. When I first saw Animal Crackers when I was like 10, like, you know, one of the first things my family rented on VHS. And, you know, when you're a kid, you have if you're instilled early, you're not prejudiced against an old movie. Like if you have to learn to not care about that stuff. But I watched it.
It's true.
It was so, so funny. And so that would be good, although that is also so dependent on the characters, which can be, like, good. Like, if you have a really strong understanding of character, it is very easy then to write jokes in that voice. Like, if someone has a strong character, I have become, over the last few years, one of the real go-to people whenever there's a Back in Black on the show.
Oh, interesting.
One of the Lewis Black segments.
Yeah.
And his voice is so strong, and for whatever reason, being an old cranky person is something I feel attuned to.
You're not cranky.
Like, thanks. It is a lot easier for me sometimes to write those jokes because I'm like, okay, well, Lewis would think this, and what's the funniest Lewis-y way to say it? So, you know, like there's that joy of writing for a character, but my other impulse is to write for something like Monty Python and the Holy Grail where you just can throw out the silliest stuff. Yeah. It doesn't necessarily have to be connected to one character or one plot. It can just go all over the place, and this is what you think is funny.
Yeah.
So we're putting it in.
Totally. That's good. I always thought Blazing Saddles would have been a fun writer's room with Mel Brooks and Richard Pryor. Yeah. And that would have been a lot of fun.
Oh, man.
All right. And finally, number five, movie going 101. What is your movie going ritual? Where do you sit? Where do you go? What do you eat?
Well, obviously, everyone has been talking about this on your show. I'm sure it's closed down theaters, but when life was normal. I would go to the Alamo Draft House in Brooklyn.
Yeah. Stuart had the same answer.
Yeah, it is, you know, it is so easy to get to from my place. You know, it's like 20 minutes by train, like straight shot. So it immediately, and it's such a much better theater experience than almost any other theater I've ever been in.
Yeah.
That it has gotten to the point that when you know, in normal life, when you can go to the theater, it was the only one at a certain point I would go to. Like, a movie wouldn't be there, and I'd be like, oh, I guess I'm waiting to see that one.
Right, yeah.
But I'm pretty boring in that I, you know, like a good center seat. I tend to go for row four at the Alamo because there's usually a bigger walkway in front of you for the servers and such.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, I'll get there early because I'm a nerd and I like to be on time. And also they have pre-shows. So even though it's reserved, I'll get there early. And I'll probably get a drink, too, since that's a wonderful thing you can do there as well.
Yeah, I love it. All right, dude. Well, that's it. Thanks.
Thank you so much.
I feel like it's been a long time coming.
Yeah.
I feel like we talked about this a couple of years ago, perhaps even.
I think so too, but it's good that I think that you were able to arrange it to stack everyone up and you know, quarantine, bad for everything else, good for podcasting.
Yeah.
Easy to get people.
Yeah. I mean, I think the reason now that I think back is that it didn't happen for so long is because I like doing these in person and they're just a lot better. And so I was waiting for it to work out with me in New York. But then once all of this shit hit the fan, and I started doing these sort of Skypes and Zooms, I thought, well, you know, this is fine because it's fun for us too. We get to have a hang for an hour and a half, and which we all need.
Yeah.
So anyway, this is great. And thanks, dude. This is awesome.
Thank you.
All right, everyone. That was a lot of fun for me. I had so much fun going back and seeing this movie again after so many years. I don't know why it kind of fell out of my rotation, but it's back in there. It was great talking to Dan. Dan is awesome, as I'm sure you agree now. Go listen to The Flophouse. It's a great, great show. So much fun. Like I said in the show, you don't have to even see these bad movies to have a good time listening to these dudes. It's just very fun and funny. And they do each bring something unique to their little trio. And they've been around for a long time for a very good reason. I am a big time flopper and it's been my comfort food. And it was great to talk to Dan for the last hour and a half about Aliens. A lot of fun. So support Max Fun, support The Flophouse, support Dan McCoy and The Daily Show. And thanks for listening, you guys. And we'll see you next week.
Movie Crush is produced, edited, and engineered by Ramsey Yunt here in our home studio at Pont City Market, Atlanta, Georgia, for iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.